implementing in passing in this session, and of course, be careful what you wish for. You might just have to implement the law that you've written yourself. So we're very pleased that the state is making a lot of advances in making sure that more of our treatment dollars are spent on things that actually make people better and improve public safety. So with that, is there anything, Mr. Wilson, that you would like to add?
Not at this time.
All right. Then Director Williams, if you could please come forward.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. Max Williams, Director of the Oregon Department of Corrections. And I'm just going to take a brief couple of minutes by way of introduction to this subject matter and then turn you over to a couple of people from DOC and OYA who really are doing the hands-on work around this issue and can talk specifically about programs. But I was asked just to give a couple of seconds of introduction regarding Senate Bill 267 and what we were really trying to achieve legislatively at the time that it was passed. And you'll recall that this was back in the 2003 timeframe. We had gone through a large number of special legislative sessions where each time we came back into session to try to find out how we were going to reduce the budget to match ever-declining revenues. And it led to a long conversation during a number of those special sessions about the impact on the public safety system and choices we were going to have to make about how to disinvest dollars in public safety and how difficult it was as a legislature at the time to feel like we had any basis upon which to make those decisions. Inversely, as we walked through that conversation, we also recognized that the same held true for any time there was additional new money and a lot of concern about how we would invest that next available dollar in public safety programs, particularly that were tied to reducing crime and making a difference in the number of offenders returning to prison, the early intervention kinds of conversations, as well as treatment. So working with Representative Rob Patridge, who was at that time chair of the Public Safety Subcommittee on Ways and Means, and myself in the Judiciary Committee, we crafted Senate Bill 267, which originally encompassed five agencies that would be impacted by the legislation: the Department of Corrections, the Oregon Youth Authority, the Commission on Children and Families, the Department of Human Services, Office of Addiction and Mental Health Treatment. So it was focused on the addiction and mental health treatment component within DHS. And the subject and the purpose was to try to focus us in a direction of investments in programs in all of those agencies that were, in fact, evidence-based. And we worked a lot with the agencies at the time. And to their credit, virtually every single agency was already moving without legislative imposition, moving that direction, embracing the notion of best practices, evidence-based practices. And so that process was already underway. It was one of the things that, frankly, made this legislation sort of easy to go through. I think the benefit of doing this was that it created a rallying point among those agencies to try to figure out how to implement evidence-based practices on a statewide basis. It also created accountability, which required that all the agencies over a three-biennium period had to come back and report to the legislature that as to their investments in programs, that they could show ever-increasing percentages of investment in programs that, in fact, were evidence-based and how that process worked. And, of course, currently we're at the point where at a minimum 25% of all the money budgeted for these types of programs, in fact, is required to be budgeted in an evidence-based program. And I think the agencies are all either meeting or, in some cases, exceeding those levels of investment. Over the next two biennium, that will move to 50 and eventually top out at 75%. There are a number of things I think we've learned during this process. Along with requiring that the investments be evidence-based, we also the legislation also requires that they determine to be cost-effective. And that's been the harder part, I think, of this effort, is to move to a sort of unified or centralized model for determining cost effectiveness. You've seen, most of you, I think, have seen, if not in person, the presentation materials by Steve Ose from the Washington Public Policy Institute. And the model that we're attempting to create in Oregon is similar to that, in an ability to gauge cost effectiveness of these kinds of investments of treatment dollars. Not because I think anyone believes that you know have a specific number that says if you put a dollar transfer and you get exactly $5.75 back in savings or cost avoidance. But you do get at least some function of scale with those. And I think what we were attempting to accomplish in 2003 was to create a tool by where legislators like yourselves, having to make difficult decisions about budgets, could start making some decisions about where they thought that next dollar of investment ought to be. The other thing it did is it acknowledged, I think, for the first time in statute, that we actually know a lot about what does and doesn't work from a treatment and intervention perspective as it relates to crime reduction, and that it directed all of those five agencies, and most of whom deliver services through private contractors, to start focusing on those issues that we know something about. We know where and how to impact treatment in treatment to have an impact on people in an appropriate way. And the effort really rallied, I think, not only the agencies, but then the contractors that we work with who provide these kinds of services to really step up their game and focusing on best practices and evidence-based programs around the country. So that was really what the effort was about and what we've been trying to accomplish. I know with respect to DOC and to some extent because Director Jester and I have had this conversation on numerous occasions, both DOC and OIA have used a program where we share resources among our staff to go out and evaluate the programs that we're operating in our various departments. And those independent teams do those reviews and analysis, and you'll hear more about this today. But that's in part underscoring a point that I'd also like to make that I think is very important about this program, and one that I didn't think about nearly enough, I think, when the legislation was moving through in 2003, and that's the ongoing need to have fidelity in these programs as they're implemented. It's one thing to say you're going to buy a particular program or you've got a program that, you know, based on its design is in fact evidence-based, but without ongoing review and kind of creating that program improvement loop that needs to be there, there's no guarantee that 2 years down the road with staffing changes or other issues that program is in fact going to be being delivered in a manner that's keeping fidelity with its design. So there is a need for that constant review and process improvement in all of these programs. And what I like most, I guess, about this legislation is I think that it creates a cooperative accountability structure between the agencies that are trying to truly change the environment that we live in, trying to really have an impact on public safety, trying to seriously reduce the number of innocent Oregonians who are becoming victims of crime by the implementation of these programs, but also an accountability loop with the legislature to ensure that you're actually getting value for what you're choosing to invest your public resources in as we try to accomplish this goal. So that's really, in very brief, sort of more of a policy overview about what Senate Bill 267 was intended to accomplish. I would tell you that it's not a panacea, and it's not a guarantee that every single program in all of these departments is necessarily operating exactly as it should be, nor is it an indication, I think, that we are touching every group of individuals who needs programming. There's a lot of folks out there where there isn't any evidence-based programs per se designed to treat particular groups of individuals or people, and that's one of the issues that I think we continue to deal with as we move forward in our efforts around this. And it's also one of the reasons why we topped the thing out at 75%, recognizing that there will always be the need for design and innovation and exception, and sometimes just generally testing theories about what will and won't work and reducing the likelihood that someone will go out and create a new victim. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to answer any questions if the committee has any. I think the information of more interest will be the two individuals who present the more detailed review of the programs themselves.
Great. Thank you, Director Williams. No, that's a great introduction. And, any questions for Director Williams? Let's get in.
Great. Thank you.
Ms. Rios. Director Jester.
Mr. Chair, Bob Jester, Director of the Oregon Youth Authority, and with me is Debbie Rios, who is our implementation specialist on evidence-based practice, who is going to walk you through a document of the progress the Oregon Youth Authority has made in the implementation of this requirement.
Good afternoon. For the record, I'm Debbie Rios. We have a packet for you today. We have the presentation document, and then we were requested to provide information on the program evaluations that we have conducted in both our community programs and our facility programs. So you'll have that information that has the initial assessment and the follow-up assessments. And then we also have a copy of the interim report that we submitted to the Judiciary Committee in the fall of 2006. So we've been asked today to provide some details regarding our evaluations of programs, any program changes that we've made, any improvements that we've made, and I'm going to try my best to do that. On page 2 of the document, when the Senate Bill 267 was first enacted, the Oregon Youth Authority and other affected state agencies made determinations of what services would come under Senate Bill 267. So on page 2, you will find those. We were looking at any treatment services, sex offender treatment, fire setting treatment, drug and alcohol treatment, skill building, gang intervention, culturally specific treatment, and gender specific treatment. So any services that are provided by a OYA close custody facility, by a residential program, by a contracted residential provider, or by our county juvenile departments using some of the pass-through OYA money, such as juvenile crime prevention, diversion services, all of those apply to Senate Bill 267 as long as they're providing these services. So one of the first actions that the Oregon Youth Authority took towards the implementation of this legislation was to determine how do we evaluate the programs. And upon review of the literature, the Oregon Youth Authority and the Department of Corrections quickly identified the Correction Program Assessment Inventory as the tool. This tool was developed in Canada by two renowned researchers, and it's based on a lot of study of correctional effectiveness of different programs. And on page 3, you can see that the Correctional Program Assessment Inventory evaluates a lot of components of a program. It'll look at the overall program implementation, look at the leader of the program, their involvement in the delivery of services, their involvement in the selection and training of staff. It also looks at offender assessments, how they're assessed, is it with a, what's the assessment method, is it an objective assessment tool. The tool also evaluates the treatment that's provided. Does the treatment focus on criminogenic targets? How does the treatment prepare an individual when they're returning to the community? The tool also looks at staff characteristics, the training of the staff, their educational background, the supervision of the staff, and how they're delivering services. It also looks at evaluations of the program. You know, are there reports on recidivism of the program? And it also looks at other kinds of characteristics, such as the ethical guidelines, the funding stability, those kinds of things that are in the program. The program has the evaluation process. It's a fairly rigorous process. It takes about all day to complete, with extensive interviews of staff, of the inmates or offenders, looking at different programs. And then there are overall ratings. And there's an overall rating of the program of unsatisfactory, needs improvement, satisfactory, or very satisfactory. And for a program to meet the compliance for Senate Bill 267, the program must have a satisfactory or a very satisfactory rating. As Mr. Williams stated earlier, the Oregon Youth Authority and Department of Corrections were trained specifically in the use of this instrument, and we also had other justice providers. And so we had adult community corrections, juvenile directors, providers that were also trained. And when we do these evaluations, they are done with a team of evaluators. On page 4, I think this slide illustrates how the Correctional Program Assessment Inventory works. This is from a study of over 63 programs in the state of Ohio with 15,000 offenders. And each program was looked at various characteristics that it had. And the offenders were followed up for 2 years in looking at those that were reincarcerated as the measure for recidivism. So if a program had an acceptable termination rate, which is the TR at the top of the box, meaning that 75 to 85% of the offenders that went through that program completed the program, that program would have a reduction in 5% versus those programs that didn't have that characteristic. If the program had that termination rate had been in existence for 3 years or more and is using cognitive behavioral interventions, when those programs were compared, offenders that left those programs had an 18% reduction in recidivism based on the programs that didn't have those program characteristics. And then finally, if the programs had those three characteristics and also focused on the criminogenic targets, if they provided skill training and role-playing with the offenders, and they focused on the risk of the offender, that reduction in recidivism was about 39%. And so when we look at programs and look at over the overall rating, the Correctional Program Assessment Inventory rates a program on 78 different characteristics. And so a program that shows very satisfactory is likely to be a program that's on the bottom of this chart that has all of these different program characteristics. When we began evaluating Senate Bill 267, Mr. Jester wanted to have all of our facilities to be evaluated first. And so these facilities were all reviewed by reviewers from the University of Cincinnati. And in this review, none of our programs met the satisfactory rating. The feedback that we got on our programs is that we had good leadership in the programs, but the programs lacked risk assessments. They lacked focusing on multiple criminogenic targets for the youth that we were serving, and they lacked a cognitive behavioral approach. And so we immediately began some quality assurance activities. And on page 6, you can see some of our efforts. We began with an evidence-based committee that consisted of our assistant directors and key leaders in the agency, and we looked at planning, implementing, and evaluating our efforts. And we focused on assessment and planning, on training, on the delivery of evidence-based treatment, on quality assurance, and then reassessing our programs and seeing how we're doing. And this is a continuous cycle. So once we reassess, we may do some additional things in assessment and planning and so forth. On page 7, you will see some of our efforts in the assessment and planning. You've heard a lot about this risk needs assessment tool that we implemented. Mr. Jester talked about the tool that was developed in the state of Washington, and the developer of that tool assisted us to match up the language with the Oregon statutes with that tool. And we began implementation in 2004. Later, we worked with the juvenile directors and the Center on Sex Offender Management and selected a risk tool to use with sex offenders. And again, we had training that was provided to our juvenile departments and OYA providers in the use of this tool.
Ms. Rios, can I ask a question about that? So in the cognitive behavioral therapy that you chose to use, there are a lot of kind of brand names for cognitive behavioral therapy, reasoning and rehabilitation, moral recognition therapy. Was there a particular one that you chose to get the staff trained in, or how did that process work?
Well, Mr. Chair, I will talk a little more about the cognitive behavior and the specific interventions that we selected. Would you like me to go through
those? Oh, no, if you do that later, that's fine.
Okay.
Sorry. Got ahead of ourselves. Please continue.
In the assessment area, we worked on the automated case plan, and then most recently we have centralized our intake. And so youth that come that are admitted to the youth authority are in a centralized intake, and this is now at our Hillcrest facility. And this allows for us to assess the quality and the integrity of that intake process. So, Mr. Chair, I hope I'll be able to answer a little bit the cognitive behavioral with this next section on training, which is on page 8.
My apologies. I was on the wrong page.
Oh. The training has been critical to the successful implementation of Senate Bill 267. And as we rolled out our training efforts, we took several strategies. Number one was that we looked for content experts to help us. So if we didn't have that expertise within the youth authority, then we sought for that expertise. We also sought technical assistance. And so the National Institute of Corrections, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration also provided technical assistance to us. And a strategy around the training was not to just train OYA, but to look at all juvenile justice partners. So when we had opportunities, we would train the juvenile departments and offer training to our residential programs and to others. A very important piece of this initiative is sustainability. And so we're looking at how we can develop internal expertise that continue this training. A last strategy that we took is that we trained the managers and leaders first so they could coach and guide the staff in the change process. So as we've mentioned, we rolled out the training on the risk needs assessment and case plan in 2004. Then we got to the cognitive behavioral interventions, and this is where we sought assistance from the National Institute of Corrections. And this was a 5-day training that we provided to all of our treatment managers and leaders in the use of cognitive behavioral interventions. And it wasn't a specific curricula that people were trained to. It was training on the concepts of cognitive therapy and behavioral therapy and how to intervene with youth, working on some cognitive restructuring and those types of things, because we wanted our staff to have a broad understanding of what it means when we're providing cognitive behavioral interventions. And that's where the National Institute of Corrections assisted us. Then we realized that we needed training for all of our staff on all of our treatment units. And so we sought a curricula, a training curricula that would do that. And we found one that the University of Cincinnati had just developed. And this training provided specific hands-on training to our staff on how to intervene with youth. And so the methodology that we used is a four-quarter method of when we want to train a skill, the staff will role model the skill, and then the youth will practice the skill. We give them graduated practice, and then they do homework. And so that's a lot of the approach that we took with that. In addition, staff were trained on cognitive restructuring kinds of interventions. And so we trained staff on how to work with youth on a cost-benefit analysis, how to do some problem solving, how to identify high-risk situations and do problem solving around that. So we did a lot of that kind of generic training in the cognitive behavioral interventions. Later on, we did select specific interventions that we've also used in providing training for that as well. So we provided that overarching cognitive-based training to every unit in every facility. And it took us over a year to do that because we would pull staff off of a particular unit and put them through the 3-day training and then put them back on the unit and have them start implementing some of the different services. In addition, we worked on a seminar with our facility staff. They did a self-assessment of their programs, looked at where they were meeting the criteria that's in the correctional program assessment inventory, where they had some weaknesses, and then they put together some action plans for that. And then the last part of the training was that when we selected specific curricula, we provided training. And oftentimes it was the developer of that curricula that we used.
And then, Ms. Rios, one last question. So every time a new qualified mental health professional comes in, they get trained in this particular realm. That has to cost a pretty penny, I would think.
Well, Mr. Chair, what we did is we restructured our training academy and for our new employees, and so we put this training into that for all of our new employees. So every new employee that comes through will get that. And then additional for the professional staff, we've developed some internal experts on the different curricula, and we have a clinical supervision process and a training. So that's how we've looked at implementing for new employees.
Great. Thank you.
The next big area was the delivery of evidence-based treatment. And some of the research was coming out on the boot camps of them not being as effective in terms of reducing recidivism. So when we looked at that, we made a determination to restructure our Tillamook Youth Accountability Camp, and it's now focusing on working with juvenile sex offenders. Another thing that we did is when we had the opportunity to reopen the North Coast facility, we looked at the population of youth that we have that are high risk and have high needs. And so we have a lot of high risk offenders that have drug and alcohol problems, drug and alcohol dependency problems. And so this gave us an opportunity to create a specialized treatment and intervention for these type of youth. The other thing that we have been doing is we've been looking at the risk needs assessments of all of the youth and finding out what are their treatment needs. And then we're looking at all of our facilities and finding out what the programs are. And so we are realigning our programs to match with what the risk and needs of are of the youth. And so, you know, having more specialization in drug and alcohol treatment, working with our sex offenders, working with youth with various cultural needs. We have one unit where we have a treatment manager that is bilingual, and so he's able to work with the youth and their families to focus on that youth's special needs. At this time, I would like to address the question that Representative Hanna, you asked about the effectiveness of our drug and alcohol treatment, and that is on page 10. I'm sorry, I don't have a very quick answer for you because this is a very complicated area that we've been working on. We conducted recidivism studies looking at our youth, and we looked at our youth that were on probation, committed to us on probation during the fiscal years of 01 through 03, and then we followed them for 3 years. We did the same for our parole youth, and when the parole were released into the community, we followed them for 3 years, looking at recidivism, which is the felony conviction or adjudication. And we found that youth with substance abuse crimes had the highest recidivism rates of all of our other crimes, and it was close to 40%. We also found that youth with property crimes also had a high recidivism rate, which is around 38%. And oftentimes, youth that come in with property crimes, it's kind of a proxy for drug and alcohol treatment problems. We also did a study where we looked at youth that were leaving, and we looked at youth that committed new crimes, and we looked at youth that didn't. And what we were looking for are predictors. What are some unique characteristics of the youth that commit new crimes versus those that didn't? We found immediately that the boys commit more crimes than girls. It's a higher rate of crimes, fairly well established in the literature. We also found that boys that had histories of probation violation, that had some histories of running, were also more likely to recidivate. But one of the most important findings that we had was that these boys that had drug and alcohol problems were twice as likely to recidivate. And so what we found is that youth with drug and alcohol problems are really drivers of our recidivism. And so we really have to target that in our programs. So 60% of our youth did not commit new crimes, but 40% with the drug and alcohol problems did. So one of the things that we worked with the Substance Abuse Mental Health Services Administration in finding a treatment curricula, and we looked at a lot of research and found a program that's actually a fairly large study, and it's referred to as the Cannabis Youth Treatment.
I think Representative Hanna had a question, if you don't mind.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just before you got past that page, the recidivism study, after 3 years, the substance alcohol crimes were 39.5%. The property offenses were 37.5%. Are the persons counted at 37.5% with property offenses also drug and alcohol? Or if you went to the next statement, which says youth with drug and alcohol problems were twice as likely, if you had property offenses and a drug and alcohol problem, did they recidivate 70% of the time?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanna, if they had a drug and alcohol problem and a property crime, it was the 38%. So it's not a double.
Okay.
It's just that if youth came in with property crimes, and when we released them, if they had a drug and alcohol problem, they were twice as likely to recidivate. So they were at the higher end of our property offenders.
Thank you.
Okay. So we have been working on this drug and alcohol treatment curricula. We selected it. It was, from what we found, the most effective drug and alcohol treatment program that focused with populations similar to the youth within the Oregon Youth Authority. And so we received the technical assistance, and they provided the folks to come out and provide training. And so we had three different series of training for our staff and providers, and we began implementation in 2005. So at this point, we're waiting for those youth to be released and be out in the community for at least a year to be able to look at the effectiveness of that enhanced intervention.
Representative Nathanson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've asked about this in other kinds of discussions, so you may have anticipated the question. You are now doing drug and alcohol treatment when it's warranted, and we'll see the results of that in a little while. At least in some venues, we hear that at least half of the people, I don't know if it applies for youth as well as adults, but at least half of the time, people with drug and alcohol problems have an underlying mental health issue. Are the youth who are receiving drug and alcohol treatment also receiving mental health treatment?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nathanson, if youth have a dual diagnosis, we do treat both of those. And I'll be talking a little bit later with our young women who you heard have the highest incidence of both drug and alcohol problems and mental health problems. We found a treatment curricula that specifically works with those women that has been researched to also have a reduction in recidivism. So we're certainly trying to address that.
Is comment?
Comment.
Thank you. I'm really glad to hear that you are. Is there someplace else in the testimony that you talk about mental health treatment, or is it something where you could, for example, if I were at home talking to constituents about the programs that are provided, is it accurate to say that this could say drug and alcohol treatment and mental health treatment where needed? Is that accurate to say? Because the words mental health treatment are omitted from this page. That's why I asked.
Representative Nathanson, from the drug and alcohol page on page 10, if I can go back to page 2 on determination of services included under Senate Bill 267, we do have mental health service as an intervention. And we have, and I didn't have this listed as our interventions that we're using, but it's a treatment intervention called coping, and it was developed by Kaiser and has been studied, and we use that as a curricula for working with youth with mental health problems. Now, youth that have a dual diagnosis, the research suggests that you shouldn't work with these problems independently, that the mental health treatment and the drug and alcohol treatment should be provided ideally by a single provider. And so we've looked at ways to do that. And our qualified mental health professionals are providing the mental health treatment and some of the drug and alcohol treatment, so they're able to do that.
Yeah. I thought I'd just comment, too, and perhaps get your impression of this. And when I was working with adults in recovery, people who've been in trouble with the law, criminals, there's a complex relationship in my experience and what I saw in the literature between drug use and criminality. So in some instances, drug use helps fuel criminality, but in other instances, people who tend to be in a criminal lifestyle are naturally drawn to drug abuse. So even if you took those people and made them clean tomorrow at that particular moment, it wouldn't necessarily mean they'd stop being involved in crime, kind of the notion of being a dry drunk if you haven't really gone through the process of becoming a better person. I just want to see if you wanted to comment.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, when Dr. Tesla was here, I took the opportunity to talk with him about that dilemma. And, you know, when he presented to the committee, he talked about the four kind of big areas to focus on, the criminogenic targets and the antisocial thinking, the antisocial behaviors being those. And so as we approach treating youth with drug and alcohol problems, we're also paying attention to those, making sure that we're addressing all of those risk factors. When they looked and evaluated our programs, I think early on we were kind of unidimensional in how we were approaching, and so we were doing drug and alcohol treatment. And then if you had a mental health problem, we'd put you on a mental health unit. And now we're working on all of those issues together and trying to treat all of those criminogenic targets. The other thing is we do have an assessment protocol, and so we have a screen, and then there is a comprehensive assessment. And so the different variables that you talked about are considered in the assessment when it's determined how to approach the drug and alcohol treatment. But given the criminality in terms of the number of youth that commit further crimes, it's very clear that we're not going to address the problem just with drug and alcohol treatment. We also have to work on the cognitive treatment and the social skills, work with the antisocial behaviors and those kinds of things.
Thank you. Please continue. Any questions?
I'm going to move to page 11, and when our programs were evaluated, it became obvious to us that we needed to select curricula that's based on manuals that we could teach our staff to implement. And so we developed a curricula design committee that consisted of top leadership, clinical, and others within the agency. And they looked at different curricula. They looked at the research of a particular curricula. Is there research that shows it's effective in reducing recidivism? But we also looked at the curricula committee would look at, well, what are the targets that this curricula works on? You know, what are the factors, the risk factors that it works on? We also looked at curricula in terms of gender, in terms of culture, and assuring that it has a cognitive behavioral approach. So anybody that wanted to provide treatment using a particular curricula would have to get reviewed by this curricula review committee. What I have for you on page 11 and 12 are just some examples of the curricula that we selected. We have, and just let me step back one step, that we tried to make sure that the curricula that we would offer to the youth would cover those multiple criminogenic risk factors. And so there's not one curricula that we can provide to a youth that's going to address all of the problems. And so we looked at, you know, what are the types of problems that youth have and how are we going to address that. So we looked at a curricula. The first one is called Responsible Thinking, and this focuses on the antisocial thoughts, focuses on the antisocial behaviors, works on problem solving and some social skills, helps youth to identify high-risk situations and alternatives to criminal activity and behavior. I talked about the drug and alcohol treatment. The next one is aggressive replacement training. This is a curricula that's fairly well known in the literature. It focuses on three things: social skills, anger control, and moral reasoning using Kohlberg's model. And it works with youth on how to handle taunting, how to avoid trouble with peers, and gives them some moral situations to do problem solving around. For example, you know, the youth finds out that his older brother is now selling drugs, and the brothers told him not to tell anybody. What do you do? And it works with adolescents to try to get them to that higher level of moral reasoning and thinking, that away from the antisocial thinking towards the more pro-social thinking.
Ms. Rios, could you please describe what you mean by moral development? I mean, because I think people have a connotation of that, and I think an explanation would be helpful.
Mr. Chair, I hope I can do that. It's working with youth, and Dr. Kohlberg developed a kind of a stages of moral reasoning to that would give for more pro-social thinking. And so an example of dilemmas, like if you and I walk in our neighborhood and we see a garage door open and it's getting close to dusk, and, you know, our thinking would be, well, gee, maybe I should let the neighbor know, you know, there's some really nice things in that garage, and I would hate for them to lose that. A youth offender might see that home and think, wow, this is a great opportunity. Look at that bike. I could really use that. You know, they've got insurance. It won't hurt them. It doesn't matter. And so that's kind of the different thought processes in terms of the thinking and the moral reasoning around that. And so we try to teach the youth in terms of making good decisions. And I know that this is an area that you have much more expertise than I do, so that was my attempt at explaining.
Yeah, no, and I just to piggyback on that is that there are some therapeutic interventions that can get people to move to higher levels of moral decision-making, not in the religious sense, but just in how you decide what to do in a particular situation.
And then the aggressive replacement training, it tries to do it working with peers, because the associates with antisocial peers is part a main problem for youth. Most juvenile crime happens with another peer, and so it's working with how youth interact with those peers around this element of moral reasoning. The Seeking Safety is the curricula that I was referring to that works with young women with dual diagnosis problems, so with both mental health. A lot of the young women have trauma issues and substance abuse, and so it really works with them on those issues, and also it was found in the research to have an effect on reducing recidivism as well. When we rolled this out, we did a partnership with a drug and alcohol treatment program with mental health, that one of the psych res programs, with the juvenile department, and with the Oregon Youth Authority. And so we have it as kind of a pilot that we're looking at the effectiveness of this intervention. On page 12,
I have a question about what you just explained. You mentioned these young women may have problems with trauma. By trauma, do you mean they may have been victims of crime or subject to abuse or neglect in the house? Is that the kind of trauma you're referring to?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Representative Nathanson, the females, Mr. Jester, has a very high percentage of being sexually abused. Some of them have been victims of crime as well, and also experienced neglect and physical abuses as well. So it's really a constellation of all of the things that you've identified as potential trauma that these young women have experienced. On page 12, we are working on a project with the University of Oregon that's referred to as working at gaining employment skills. This is a curricula developed by Dr. Bullis and colleagues from the University of Oregon. It's been piloted in research with the Springfield School District. Dr. Bullis did some research within the Youth Authority in the late 90s, and he found that youth that were at McLaren, if they had vocational training, they were less likely to recidivate than those that didn't. And so this curricula has been developed to kind of target that vocational readiness. And this is an example of a curricula that's being implemented in the schools. So it's the school program that's doing this. We also have a parenting curricula, one developed by the Social Learning Center, that is working with our youth that are parents and teaching them to be good parents. And this is a research project that's in collaboration with the Department of Corrections. And I think someone asked the question, how many of our youth are parents? And it's around 19%, so it's a fair number of youth. And so we've gone through the first use of this curricula. We're, again, waiting for time in terms of looking at some of the impact of the curricula, because when youth return home, some will have their children come back to the home with them. And so it's something that we're looking at closely. The Street Smarts was a program that was developed by our Office of Minority Services, where they're focusing on alternatives to a gang lifestyle, looking at risky thinking, looking at barriers to crime and to lead a crime-free lifestyle. And then the Functional Family Therapy is an evidence-based program that we've implemented for youth going home. We can do a lot of work with youth that are in our care, but ultimately, as Mr. Jester always reminds me, the majority of youth will be going home. And so we want to make sure that we can work with that family and use an evidence-based approach as that youth is reintegrating back in. On page 13, Mr. Williams talked about the fidelity and the importance of fidelity measures. The Youth Authority uses fidelity measures to assess the quality and delivery of all of our treatment services. In some cases, these measures are developed by the developers of the curricula. So Functional Family Therapy has a measure that looks at how well is this program being implemented and how competent is the person that's implementing this. The Dr. Latessa just briefly talked about this, but the state of Washington did a study, and they found that when programs were not competently delivered, and they looked at functional family therapy and aggressive replacement treatment training, they found that actually recidivism would be increased. It would be better not to go through the program with an incompetent therapist than just to not take it at all. And so that's why when we look at the research and we look at programs that have good outcomes in terms of reducing recidivism, we have to make sure that we're implementing it in the way that it was designed and that the therapists that are providing that service are competent and doing it in a competent manner. So that's something that we're just really starting on. We've been training our treatment managers. We also have videotapes of our staff doing groups, and those are reviewed. And we're trying to integrate this into everyone's performance evaluation.
And I know a lot of well-run programs that do training on things. I think Functional Family Therapy also sends out people to sit in on your groups once or twice a year to make sure that you're delivering them correctly. Is any of that going on in Hawaii?
Mr. Chair, I'm pleased to say yes. We have a contract with Functional Family Therapy Incorporated, and they actually do clinical supervision where tapes are sent to them. We have someone that's doing quality assurance. So as we've implemented the different programs across the state, we're coordinating with them the quality of those programs. And I will say that there are some therapists that, as a result of those, have been released from those responsibilities. Functional Family Therapy has a self-assessment of the parent and the youth and the provider, and so they look at every session and look at the outcomes there.
And could you get the committee in the future, maybe the part of Steve Aos's analysis that some of your programs
are listed in that report, and it gives a cost-benefit analysis not only to taxpayers but to crime victims. And I think functional family therapy was like $13 for every dollar invested.
Mr. Chair, we'd be more than happy to do that, and I think that many of the programs that we have implemented are on the Washington State list.
Great. Thank you.
The page 14 looks at our program reassessments, and Mr. Flora talked about this a little bit yesterday. One thing I want to say about the reassessments is when we talk about the reassessments, we now talk about the correction program checklist. And it's essentially the same tool as the correctional program assessment inventory. There were just some changes that were made based on a very large study with both adolescent and adult corrections, and they made some adjustments to that. But a very satisfactory on one scale is equal to a very satisfactory on the other. You will see that when we first conducted the CPAI in our facilities, that none of the facilities reached a satisfactory level. You can see now in 2006, when we began the reassessments of our facilities, 57% of our facilities, the units, various units in our facilities, now meet that standard of satisfactory or very satisfactory. 7 out of our 10 facilities, all of the units are now at a satisfactory or above. You also see significant improvement with our community residential programs. The challenge for us now, as we make this satisfactory mark, is to get to the very satisfactory. Dr. Latessa just briefly talked about this, but the programs that are very satisfactory have almost a twice of an impact on reducing recidivism. And so it's something that we really want to get to in terms of moving up, because this really is not about a program getting a satisfactory or very satisfactory. It's ultimately about reducing recidivism. And so we have to keep kind of pushing in that arena. On page 15, this slide looks at the program expenditures. The 2005-07 legislative-approved budget is around $246 million. Of that, approximately $60 million of total funds are subject to Senate Bill 267. 41 are general funds and 19.1 are federal funds. The parts that are subject to Senate Bill 267 are the provision of the treatment, so the sex offender treatment, the drug and alcohol treatment, all of those kinds of things. So to date, the standard was 25%. So to date, actually it was in August, that 47% of those funds that are subject to 267 are evidence-based using our evaluation methodology. And we are already now at the 50%. So when we start the 07-09 biennium, we will be at that minimum standard of 50%. Just want to real briefly talk about two research projects. The University of Oregon, Dr. Deanne Unruh, has written several grants, and we're involved in two research projects. One is funded by the U.S. Department of Education, and that's to validate our risk needs assessment. It's very important for us to have this as a validated tool so we can make improvements on the ways that we can predict risk. We need to find out when a kid comes in to have a high predictability of this youth is most likely to offend, you know, so we need to do these things. We also, the University of Oregon also received funding from the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention to evaluate the wages program, and so that started in January of 2007. We're going to continue our efforts on studying recidivism, looking at effectiveness of treatment, recidivism of our programs, and predicting of risks. So real quickly, I'll address our next steps as we see them on page 17. We're going to continue our realignment of the facility programs that are focusing on the youth needs and risks. All of the units are working on very detailed action plans. Another piece is that we're going to work on increasing the intensity of evidence-based treatment services within our close custody facilities. What the literature is finding is that with high-risk youth you need a higher dosage of treatment. And the research is saying, you know, it looks like it's about 300 hours of treatment that we need to make that impact on those higher risk youth. And so we're looking at how we can increase the intensity of services in our correctional facilities. We also see a need to make sure that our parole probation staff have sufficient skills and knowledge of the services that are provided so they can continue the interventions with youth when they come back to the community. We've identified where we want to match up better the youth risks and needs with youth in the community programs. Many times youth have gotten into those programs because there's a vacant bed. Now we want to match up better so we can address the needs and risks of those youth. And finally, we see a need for further development of family-based services for youth returning home. So that concludes my presentation.
Well done. Questions? Senator Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If a constituent asked me, why are you guys doing this Senate Bill 267, you know, why are you spending all this time and energy, can you sort of just give me two or three sort of reasons that I can tell them that we should be continuing to do this?
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, the very first reason is really a part of our mission, and when youth are committed to us, we want no new crime. And we want to be able to intervene with the youth so they will not go out and commit a new crime. And so the evidence base gives us a roadmap. It forces us to look at what's happening, look at the outcomes to work towards that goal. And so our goal is ultimately to reduce crime. A second piece with the evidence base is to give the youth the skills and knowledge to be successful and productive young citizens. And it, you know, to hear the youth that testified, that talked about the jobs, that talked about, you know, the struggle that they had with the drug and alcohol treatment, to talk about buying a home. So, you know, that's another part of our mission. I think another piece is just to work towards having the best, the most effective treatment that we can have so it's more cost-effective. So we're not just trying everything and see what works, you know, it's what sticks. We want to try to drill down a little bit so we're not spending a lot of money doing things that aren't going to have the outcomes.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. All right, next up is, I presume, Ginger Martin from the Oregon Department of Corrections. Ms. Martin. And Director Lopez.
Good afternoon, Chair Shields, members of the committee. I'm Ginger Martin, Assistant Director with the Department of Corrections, responsible for the Transitional Services Division. I'm going to be speaking from the notes that look like this, which you should have a copy of. And I'll be going through our process at the department to implement Senate Bill 267, both in our institution programs and also in cooperation with our community corrections partners. So I'll be talking about both parts of the system. First, I'll talk about how we made the decision about what's in and what's out, what does Senate Bill 267 apply to among all of the responsibilities that we have. And on the prison side of our business, we, at that time, which was 2004, had a programs division and an institutions division, and we brought those two groups together to look at all of the activities that happen in prisons and to sort out which of those activities are primarily designed to reduce recidivism. And so what we ended up with is the list that you see there, our alcohol and drug treatment programs, our cognitive change programs, and our parenting skills program. A little different process to go through that sorting for community corrections. We have an advisory committee, the department does, called the Community Corrections Commission, and it includes members from community corrections directors, sheriffs, county commissioners, the Board of Parole, the Criminal Justice Commission, a representative from a crime victims group, so it's a kind of a broad-based group. And we went to that existing advisory group to help us look at community corrections, decide what tool to use, and what programs should the tool be applied to, and that's the list that you see under community corrections. And it's a larger list because more activities are happening in the community. Of course, it includes the same programs, alcohol and drug treatment and cognitive programs, parenting skills programs. Also included mental health care to the extent that any of those programs were designed to reduce recidivism. Sex offender treatment, domestic violence treatment, employment programs, anger management programs, and life skills programs. So that was a decision made by the commission, and we followed their advice in terms of what programs to look at in the community.
Before you go forward to the commission,
pardon me?
Could you tell us about the commission?
Chair Shields, that was the advisory group that I mentioned earlier that includes community corrections, county commissioners, sheriffs, a crime victim representative, Board of Parole, Criminal Justice Commission. So it's a broad-based group.
Is that statutory in the bill? Or
Chair Shields, it was a pre-existing advisory group to the department whose mission was to look at improving community corrections practices generally, and so it was a natural group for us to go to for this kind of advice.
Great, thank you.
In both processes, the second question is, after what do we look at, is how do we determine if the program is an evidence-based program? And in both cases, the Corrections Program Assessment Inventory, now the Corrections Program Checklist, was the tool chosen. You heard quite a bit about that tool from Ms. Rios. If I might restate what it does in sort of the way that I think about it, it's a way of matching up the characteristics of an existing program with the characteristics of programs that have already been proven to reduce recidivism. So it's looking for the degree of match between those characteristics we know make a difference and the actual program that we're looking at. It requires an on-site visit, and we send out teams to do those kinds of assessments, very similar to the way that OIA has applied the process. And in fact, we have shared staff between OIA and the department to do cross-department reviews. So getting to the results of our assessment, starting first with the percentage of dollars invested in prison-based programs. Today, we're looking at 71% of the department's dollars invested in programs being invested in programs which score satisfactory or very satisfactory on the tool, and 29% of our dollars invested in a program which is still scoring at the needs improvement level.
Mr. Chair?
Yeah, Senator Whistler.
Just a question. I see the percentages. What's the amount of money you're actually spending on the, quote, evidence-based program?
Chair Shields, Senator Westland, if you will turn the page, you will find dollar amounts.
I don't want to wait that long.
Then I'll just tell you. Almost $9 million invested in programs designed to reduce recidivism. Of that total, $6.4 million are invested now in programs which we can demonstrate through the application of the CPC that they are evidence-based programs.
And then follow up. How many, then, of the population, both in DOC and community corrections, what percent of the population are these dollars touching in a meaningful way? I mean, I don't need a specific answer. Maybe I don't need it if you don't have it.
Mr. Chair, Senator Westland, we are reaching about half of those who we would prioritize for cognitive change programs. In other words, the high-risk, high-need group that we want in those programs, we're reaching about half of those. We're reaching about 40% of those that we would prioritize for alcohol and drug programs. It's a harder question to answer with our parenting programs because we don't have a way necessarily of prioritizing the parenting programs, although we're working on some way to do that. Parenting programs, we're not necessarily targeting parenting to people who are most likely to reoffend. We're targeting parenting programs to people who are parenting young children. And so it's a different way of assessing the need for the program.
Maybe you explain that for Senator Brown.
If I recall, I can't remember if I asked you, Jenny, or Max, but you were going to get me the kind of the base numbers of what what we're looking at is, you know, hundreds of people, thousands of people who are in that treatment gap who aren't getting services, so that we have a fair understanding of that when we make the budget decisions.
We are doing that.
Mr. Chair, just,
Senator Wesson.
Just to follow up, this is a subjective question, because you're not that far into it, but I think a good determinant of the success of these programs or future success, you know, any program is reflected in the attitude of those, you know, recipients of the program. Are you seeing an improvement in the attitude or the acceptance, if you will? I'm not articulating this very well.
Or assaults on staff or behavior?
Yeah, I mean, is there any indices that both subjective or real outcomes that you can tell us about in terms since you've implemented this?
Chair Shields, Senator Westland, since you asked a subjective question, that means I can give a subjective answer, yes?
Yeah.
Okay.
No, it doesn't.
My experience with offenders who are receiving treatment in programs that are specifically designed for offenders oftentimes say things like, this is the first time I've understood this. This program makes more sense to me than the other programs that I've been in. And so my personal experience has been that offenders do relate better to programs when they're designed specifically for that population. Not a scientific answer, but...
Yeah, but it's so much. And hey, I mean, I appreciate key performance measures and outcome-based stuff. But a lot of this is the attitude not just of the prisoners, but the staff that's reporting back to you. I mean, you know or you don't. You know, okay, now we can quantify this, but and I appreciate that answer.
We did the first review of our prison-based programs, because there are fewer of them, it's easier to sort of do the 100%, in 2004. And at that time, three programs scored in the unsatisfactory range. One was in the needs improvement, and two were satisfactory or very satisfactory. So I'll go on later in the presentation to show you the change in scores, but you can see that there has been quite a lot of improvement. We are delivering no unsatisfactory programs now in the institutions as a result of doing this review in 2004, working on some specific recommendations and improvements in 2005, and doing a re-review in 2006. Let me now talk about the pie graph that reflects the dollars invested in community corrections programs. There are about 150 programs across the state that are in the what's in or what needs to comply with Senate Bill 267. We have not yet evaluated every one of those programs. We did start with the larger programs, those programs that tended to have a greater investment of state dollars so that we could establish our 25% for this biennium as efficiently as possible. Where we are now is we can say that 36% of the dollars invested in community corrections programs are invested in evidence-based programs, and 31% are not, and then the other third we haven't yet evaluated yet. If they sort out about the same, then it's looking like right now we're about 50-50 in the field for programs that score satisfactory or very satisfactory, or programs that are not yet at that level. And then the next slide will tell you the dollar amounts. About $11.3 million invested in total. Of those programs reviewed and determined to be evidence-based, the value there is about $4.1 million. So I'd like to talk now about some of the things that we did to improve our system as a result of doing the reviews and using the specific recommendations from the tool. One of the values of this particular tool, the Corrections Program Checklist, is that in going through the tool, you're identifying the strengths that the program has, and you're also identifying very specifically some areas that the program could address to raise their score, become more evidence-based, and therefore become more effective. So it provides a lot of information for both the contractor, and that would be the Department of Corrections in this case, or a community corrections agency, and lots of good information for the program provider as well, as to what they ought to be paying attention to and perhaps addressing first to to make the biggest leap in improvement. So the major things that we did in the prison system was to implement a cognitive behavioral curriculum that specifically addresses criminal thinking in alcohol and drug treatment programs. The curriculum that we chose, in working with our providers, we contract all of our alcohol and drug treatment services to nonprofit providers, and you may remember from our budget hearing a couple of representatives were here from those programs. So in cooperation with our contractors, we determined that we wanted to adopt a standard curriculum, making it easier for continuity of care from inside to outside, so that if a program in the community wanted to continue using the same concepts and language, they would more easily be able to do that because we would be using similar language in all of our programs. So our providers chose the curriculum called Criminal Conduct and Substance Abuse Treatment, and we have brought in a trainer to train everybody on those programs, and we are now building internal capacity to continue that training as new staff come into the system.
Ms. Martin, can I ask you a question? Mm-hmm. The staff, the multidisciplinary staff from both agencies, do they go into the pool of what your total treatment dollars are? Or are they outside? So let's say you put in $10 million for evidence-based practices. Does the evaluation of those practices go into that $10 million, or is that outside?
Chair Shields, I'm sorry. I'm not understanding the question.
You have, let's say you have two staff who evaluate the program. Do you include them in your pool of dollars for evidence-based practices, or are they listed outside of that 10?
Chair Shields, our research staff for the department evaluate our programs. Is that...
And that's separate from the
dollars. The dollar figures that you see here are specific to program delivery, and they are, for us, in any case, all contract dollars. So they're all going out to these service providers.
Gotcha. Okay, thank you. Yes, Senator Beth.
While we're at a question, and this might be not be the best point, but I think I'm kind of following on Senator Wilson's question was really getting at the question I was asking earlier, and I guess you answered the question about, you know, what's different and what you're saying, at least, you know, in terms of word of mouth, inmates are saying, you know, it makes more sense to me. I think the question I would ask you is, can we measure a reduction in recidivism since we've implemented Senate Bill 267? And I guess I'd be asking the same thing for the OIA folks. Can we look at, since we passed 267, can you see a reduction in recidivism rates, and can we trace that back to the kind of programming we're doing in the corrections? Because, and the reason I say this is because a decade ago I sat through all these great stories about inmates coming forward and, you know, just, you know, real tearjerkers, whatever. And I don't know that, I mean, I thought the success stories this session were great too, and I don't know that I can directly attribute those successes to the evidence-based practices or not. I mean, I just don't know that there's a distinction there. So, mm-hmm. Sorry, I'm monologuing, Mr. Chair, but...
Mr. Chair, Senator Brown, we in the department do have a strong commitment to evaluate our programs and to make sure that they actually are making the differences that we intend for them to make and to change them if they're not. We will evaluate these programs. We continue to evaluate them. We have been hampered somewhat in our retrospective evaluations because we were not able to create a matched group that was matched on the alcohol and drug severity.
Okay.
We have now instituted a standardized intake assessment process that includes that information. So
you can trace.
So from about a year ago or so, yes, we can create those untreated addicted groups that match the treated groups.
Okay.
Meanwhile, we've made substantial changes in the programs. So say the new design program was in place as of 2006, we can, into the future, look at the comparison between the 2006 group and a matched group who didn't receive the treatment.
Mr. Chairman, if I could, one of the points that I try to make when we talk about sort of the general theory around Senate Bill 267 was a recognition that there would be no way for state government or even for any particular agency to do the in-depth, long-term, longitudinal study on every single program. It takes an immense amount of resources, an immense amount of development of the research model to implement. And so one of the theories around Senate Bill 267 was this concept that if you set some standards at the front end and said programs have to meet certain standards that have been proven over time to reduce recidivism, if they're implemented correctly and if there's that fidelity, you will more likely than not on the back end get the kind of results that you had hoped for if the program was designed appropriately. So it was to some degree designed to be a front end model to say, well, we're not going to be able to go out and run a longitudinal study on every single program that every single county is running in community corrections. But if we can hold everybody to a standard that says we're going to require some demonstration of evidence-based review at the front end to determine that the program at least meets those design criteria and has some fidelity to its delivery, then we're at least more likely assured than we were before 267 that we're going to get the kind of results we wanted on the back end. And so to some degree, that was the reason we focused on that front. There was a lot of people who said, look, you got to look at the outcomes. It's all about the outcomes. And I think that's true. In the long run, it is all about the outcomes. But there is not a process in place now, nor can I think the state afford, frankly, to run long-term 5-10-year longitudinal studies on every one of these programs to get that exact kind of research-based data that we wanted. And so the idea was if we front-ended it, we could at least get closer to the kind of programs that all the evidence suggests reduces people's intent to go out and commit new crimes upon release. I mean, that was what we were trying to change.
Mr. Chair.
Hello.
So ideally we should be seeing right about now, as programs have been implemented, we should be seeing a reduction in recidivism rates.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Brown, remembering that recidivism is a trailing indicator, that the recidivism data that we're reporting now is recidivism on data for people who were released 3 years ago, those cohorts that got released. So it's
267.
So it's a trailing indicator, and you have to, not everybody, obviously, but as that group goes on. So, hopefully, over time, we're going to see the impact of this, and the impact will be both, through OIA, DOC, and these programs being instituted at the community level.
Thank you.
Senator Nathanson, Representative Nathanson, then Senator Bussell.
I'll be representative. Fine.
I'm great for a day. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is it all right if I shift gears for a minute from the policy and results side to the money side?
Yep.
Is that okay?
That's why we're here.
All right.
What?
It's critical to understand that we're getting the results that we expect. And now I'm trying to figure out the investment that we're making. One of the things that has fascinated and frustrated me no end is being unable at times to figure out what our investment is from a program perspective, rather than this department does this a little bit and it costs this much, and this department does the same thing with a little bit different set of people, but it's the same kind of service, and you have to look in two or three or four different agencies and departments to find out what all you're doing to help a certain program area. So when I'm thinking about what we're doing with programs designed to reduce recidivism, it's not just in one department. This is an outcome we want to achieve, yet it's in several agencies. So I need some help with the numbers here. I'm looking at what we've just heard from the Department of Corrections, and if I add state general fund and federal funds in prison programs designed to reduce recidivism, it's roughly $9 million. And now we've just arrived at the page where the funds that you pass along to community programs designed to reduce recidivism, that's another $11 million. So I add the 9 and 11, and that's $20 million for programs designed to reduce recidivism. But then I was looking at the page from the presentation from Oregon Youth Authority, programs designed to reduce recidivism, and talking about evidence-based practices, and it looks like a lot more money, but their part of the budget is actually smaller than yours, and the population they serve is smaller. So would you help me understand this
investment that we're making, the difference in investment that's coming in your presentation, the size of investment, your presentation versus OIA?
Chair Shields, Representative Nathanson, my understanding is I'm going to answer a little bit for OIA and they can correct it. But I believe that OIA's look at evidence-based practices is much more inclusive than ours. Ours is simply the program dollars that we contract for. I mean, the service we contract for. And I believe that the OIA approach is a more 24-hour comprehensive approach to changing behavior.
Ms. Rios.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nathanson, the $60.6 million with the OIA are those services that are targeting the expenditures that are targeting the services of the different treatment interventions. And so that consists mostly of salaries of our qualified mental health professionals, those providing treatment. In terms of our staff that are on the unit, we did a job analysis and looked at how much time our group life coordinators are involved in the delivery of skill training. And so we used that small percentage and put that in. The majority of the dollars of the unit staff are, you know, for the safety, security, supervision, basic care, and those aren't included in the Senate Bill 267 dollar amount.
Are not.
And just following up on that, Ms. Martin, does DOC have qualified mental health professionals? And I guess at the end of the day, are we looking at just calculation of apples and oranges and how you determine what goes into 267?
Chair Shields, I think that is a part of it. I believe we have qualified mental health professionals. Certainly we have qualified mental health staff who work in the institutions. And when we originally went through our what's in, what's out discussion, we conceptualize our mental health services more similarly to our health services in that this is basic care that must be provided. The primary purpose is not to reduce recidivism, but to address the mental health needs of our folks. And that's the reason you don't see mental health on this list. Although we are rethinking that decision in terms of our co-occurring disorder programs, which currently exists organizationally in our mental health department, but those programs have really a dual purpose and they're addressing a dual problem, and we would like to know how those programs score on this sort of evaluation.
I think we're getting a sense of how complicated it is to answer very simple questions. Senator Wessel.
Well, maybe the simple explanation is, or part of it anyway, just a way to think of this, is that Oregon Youth Authority spends a much higher percent of their budget on program. Department of Corrections has much higher fixed costs, institutional costs, and even down to the community correction level, buildings and staff, jails, prisons. I mean, I think that's a real simple 101 answer. So.
Would you concur with that?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Nathanson, Senator Westland, I mean, one thing that we might do is to just sort of clarify this, is to sit down with Mr. Wilson and maybe come up with a template that captures sort of the similar things on the page with respect to the investments in these kinds of programs. I know in working as a member of the Governor's Methamphetamine Task Force, one of the issues that we have tried to do is to have all the agencies involved in that conversation capture current policy option packages and current governor's recommended budget investments in those kinds of areas. And so this is a problem that we always have, is these kinds of issues are being addressed multiple agencies, and how you count and what you put in and what you include in your sort of evaluation. We used a very strict construction for purposes of this presentation, just those services that we're contracting out to buy the service, but we're not including any of the other Department of Corrections support pieces that, that obviously allow that service to be delivered inside the institutions. But if we wanted to come up with a template and answer those questions, we certainly could do that working with OIA to sort of give you a better apples-to-apples sort of comparison if you'd like us to do that.
And I think it's, and I may have mentioned this to you when we were meeting in my office, I think most of us on this committee, in fact, I'll say all of us, would like to figure out a way to make sure that we're doing everything we can to reduce recidivism. And so if you could, once you have the numbers on what the treatment gap, you know, just kind of finalize those, if you could get us a sense of what it would take to provide maybe three additional steps of getting evidence-based practice that reduces recidivism to these folks. I think even if we can't fund it this time around, we should at least know what those numbers are.
We'd be happy to put that together, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. And, Ginger, we're getting late, so maybe if you could just hit a couple of highlights and take us home.
My favorite chart is this bar chart. Which shows the initial score on our alcohol and drug programs. These are the programs that we had the most problems with. These were where the three unsatisfactory scores were found, and so we spent most of our organizational energy on bringing these programs up to a better level. And quite frankly, they have exceeded my hopes for how well they are doing today. So what you see there is the initial score for the alcohol and drug programs at Columbia River, that's the men's program, the women's program at Coffee Creek, the Hispanic program at OSCI, and a program that we closed, redesigned, and reopened, closed a program at EOCI in Pendleton. It was not designed according to evidence-based practices and consequently, of course, didn't score very well at all. We really saw it as a whole design problem, and we redesigned the program, we rebid the service, we invested some state federal, some federal grant money also to allow us to create something much more intensive, and that's the program that now has received the highest score of any program that we've reviewed in the adult system, a 93. And I think that speaks to, this chart speaks to two things. One is the kind of improvement that a program can make when they see clearly where to address their efforts and what to do different. That's the majority of the improvement here. And then the other thing I think this tells us is when you design a program, define it from the start according to the principles from the research and start it on the right track, then it really does start on the right track, and we should see some differential results from this kind of these kind of scores across the board in our alcohol and drug programs.
Senator Burdick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is there any way that you can compare? These are stunning results, by the way. This is really fabulous. Is there any way you can compare the results you've got here to, say, the results you've gotten at Shutter Creek to boot camp, which, from everything I hear, is not particularly an evidence-based program? Is there anything you can do to make the boot camp more evidence-based, and do you have any data on whether you've seen any improvement on that?
Chair Shields, Senator Burdick, we have a similar concern about the services that are being delivered at the boot camp. We think that we can redesign that program to make it much more consistent with the evidence, much more cognitively oriented. And we are actually in the midst of putting a plan together, working with the staff down there about how to do that. And you asked about results, and I think...
If I could follow up, will this be getting away from the boot camp model and more toward an A&B type of model, or will this be sticking with the boot camp model?
Representative Shields, Senator Burdick, we do have legislation proposed this session that would give us flexibility as to the military model. Currently, that's in statute, so we aren't able to move away from it. We would like to have the flexibility to keep the parts of, say, physical discipline and exercise that might be beneficial to people, meanwhile incorporating more of the cognitive change, addressing antisocial attitudes, planning for successful transition, spend more time on those kinds of activities. Probably or not necessarily addressing alcohol and drug issues, because we have a group of of high-risk offenders who don't have serious alcohol and drug problems, and we need to have some kind of intensive intervention for those people.
That's good. I'm glad to get that on the record, Mr. Chair, because when we did the meth package, we intended to give that kind of flexibility, and I guess we didn't get quite all the way there. So I'll really look forward to seeing that legislation when it comes through. Thank you.
Representative Cameron.
Yeah, I know it's late, but just dawn on me. The at OCI, we have a transition program, I think. I got to witness that. Where is that in this program? And I think isn't there a policy option package to add some of those people? And where does that fit into this?
That particular transition program isn't reflected in the dollar totals that you see here or the review. It was sort of a pilot program. As we're thinking about expanding that, I think we're going to have to incorporate it into our Senate Bill 267 reporting and compliance evaluation and so on once it's a real program.
Hello?
I guess it was when I got to watch it and listen to the instructor, I guess the person who was in charge of it, they talked about it being a program that would reduce recidivism and gets these people prepared. I mean, I would have expected it to see it in this as one of the prison programs that were as evidence-based, or why are we going to pursue it further?
Mr. Chairman, and if I could, Representative Cameron, we fully believe, and we think that the evidence around the country shows that investment in preparing people for transition back into the community, in fact, does meet evidence-based standards, and there's an evidence-based approach to addressing that. The reason that it wasn't included, I think, in the initial Senate Bill 267 review is the only place we were currently doing that level of intensive reentry preparation inside the institutions was really only happening at OSCI alone. And part of the policy option package that sits in front of this committee for the department right now includes some additional transition coordinators that would be implementing similar kinds of programs at our other releasing institutions. And that's the point I think Ginger made, that if we move to that level of sort of expanding that program, we would definitely need to include it in the Senate Bill 267 analysis and provide that kind of review to ensure that it meets those requirements. But to a great degree, that was a program that was somewhat almost homegrown at OSCI. And, you know, our sense is, and the experience around the country has been, that focusing on that transition and reentry period, both prepping people to go out and then what happens when they hit the ground in the community, is that critical point that's going to have a lot to do with whether they succeed or not. Many of the people who go through that program, however, to the extent that we've been able to prioritize them, I guess I should be careful about how I say that, a number of those people would have received some level of transitional services at the other institutions they're releasing from, but not to the same level of approach that was being offered at OSCI.
Thank you. All right, colleagues, if you would like to stick around and ask the director some more questions, feel free. I really appreciate the great job that you all have done, and I feel very confident that people under your care are getting quality service. And thank you very much for your time and making this presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.